Well, responsibility on spending has now become the defining issue in politics, and this whole Tea Party movement is there to hold politicians accountable. They've replaced a lot of big spending Republicans. We call it a hostile takeover of the Republican Party.
Well, so much for that. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Reason Podcast, which you should totally subscribe to on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I am your host, Dish person, Matt Welch, joined by Catherine Mangu Ward and Peter Suderman in our DC office. Holla, you two.
Holla.
Hi, everyone.
Well done. And also by Nick Gillespie. Just grunt, Nick. Thank you.
That was an exceptional grunt.
Well, that was the name of his gutter punk band in 1982.
Exceptional grunt, yes.
You know. What we were listening to at the top was an August 2010 interview that Nick conducted with Matt Kibbe, then of FreedomWorks. Back then, he was arguably as close to a sort of leader that the leaderless movement known as the Tea Party movement had at the time. Fast forward to this weekend, the very same Matt Kibbe wrote a piece for Reason.com with the headline, "The Tea Party is officially dead." What killed it, if we want to put a time of death on the thing, I would argue was on Friday when a Republican Congress and a Republican president signed into law, despite the many lamentations of Rand Paul, a new two-year budget deal that blew apart what remaining caps there were on sequestration spending cuts back in the 2011 Budget Control Act and 2013 cuts and things, and also raised government spending by $300 billion over the next couple of years. There is no fiscal discipline. Debts are going to zoom past the trillion-dollar level, which occasions the question, Nick Gillespie, since I think we can blame you for most of this.
Oh, yeah.
But also since you were in the catbird seat with Kibbe back in the day, did we get the Tea Party wrong? Did we look and squint at this thing and said, must be about fiscal conservatism or sanity, when in fact it was about something else? What is your take on what we have seen here in this death?
Yeah, I'll rush to add that 2010 interview with Matt Kibbe also featured Dick Armey, if people remember him, the former House Majority Leader, who was one of the founders of FreedomWorks. And even in that interview in 2010, if I'm recalling it properly, Matt Kibbe was very much on the side of saying, you know, it's got to be fiscal discipline and we've got to, you know, just stop spending as much as possible. Dick Armey was always willing to kind of hem and haw a little bit on that because, you know, when it came to defense or when it came to social issues, he could easily be kind of driven off of that, you know, that one big main point, which I think, Matt, you and I, when we wrote about the Tea Party movement, our essential insight was correct, which was actually that the Tea Party movement would be most effective when it was most focused simply on spending. And that was its early message. It wasn't even really talking about taxes. It was just that we are spending too much. And it really was, you know, it kind of germinated in the last days of the Bush administration when, George W. Bush signed TARP, when he did auto bailouts, when he expanded the purview of the bailouts from banking to auto companies and things like that. And then Barack Obama came into office, and one of the first big things he did was expand TARP even further, but also put through a stimulus plan that, ultimately did not have anything like the, you know, we can debate the fine points of it. The one thing that we cannot, you know, is not open for debate is that it didn't achieve any of the targets it set for itself. It was a waste of money. And what happened to the Tea Party, though, is that by 2010, 2012, even as it was still helping to elect people like Rand Paul and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and Thomas Massie and Justin Amash, et cetera, it had already strayed from the focus of stopping spending overall, and it was starting to carve out exceptions for defense spending. It was starting to talk about immigrants. And the moment that it started to allow for more spending, I think it started to dissipate. And, you know, and we get what we have in the past and on Friday, where a bunch of people who were Tea Party, you know, kind of charter members of the Tea Party in Washington, voting in favor of just the terrible budget deal.
Suderman, there was a bunch of the other thing that was emphasized heavily at the initial Tea Party protests and rallies, many of which many of us went to, covered, and et cetera, was Obamacare, opposition to Obamacare, all that season of 2009, all these town hall meetings, people shouting at their representatives over this. I think part of what we and certainly I wrote a lot at the time is that we defended those town hall rallies as not being evidence of an incipient jackbooted fascism, which is not a hyperbolized thing. People were writing that. Ichi Dion was writing about
without
that
ever stopping to define what jackboots are. I mean, I got to tell you, I use this term, you know, probably six or seven times a day, and I don't really know what jackboots are. Is it like jackfruit, but for boots? And I don't know what jackfruit is either. But it's
and was there a new jackboots that came out in the mid-90s? These are all the questions that we need to ask.
Free Jack. Was Free Jack part of the jackboot movement?
The Obamacare component of it. What happened to anti-Obamacare politics and the passion behind it? And how does that get into your sort of analysis of whither the Tea Party, which is now a dead corpse,
my big
the other types.
Worry as a coastal denizen of Acela land, honestly, is to be dominated by Chelsea boots or maybe by like Chukka boots. Just Chukka before we go any further.
Peter Suderman, fashionista.
Before we go any further, you know, brief full disclosure, I worked with Matt Kibbe and Dick Armey at FreedomWorks for about a year during the Bush administration. This was pre-Tea Party, before that was a thing or even kind of a glimmer in anyone's eye. But just to get that out of the way, I think the big
Wait, Sarah, I'm sorry. This is very important for our listeners. Did people inside FreedomWorks on the side make jokes about Dick Armey's name?
No.
Oh, damn it. Go on.
Not that I heard of. So I think that the Tea Party suffered from a kind of a multiple personality disorder. I mean, it was built on a base of, on the one hand, really just kind of a reactionary opposition to President Obama and to his election, and to, you know, some of which was frankly racially tinged, but also at the same time a really earnest, I think not awful backlash to the big spending of the Bush years and a lot of the kind of frustrations that when I was at FreedomWorks, for example, we spent a lot of time saying, hey, Republicans are big spenders being led by the Bush administration, and that is bad. And so the Tea Party was also an outgrowth of that. And then on top of that, there was a lot of, I think, visceral but kind of shallow opposition to Obamacare. And I say that it was, you know, visceral but shallow, because a lot of it came from people who didn't really understand Obamacare, who didn't really know what it was going to be, and in particular from seniors who were never going to be on Obamacare or Obamacare plans, but were warned by Republicans that Obamacare would cut Medicare. And in fact, it did reduce future planned Medicare spending in order to pay for Obamacare plans. I think it's really telling if you go back to the 2012 election, Mitt Romney's probably his biggest single criticism of Obamacare was that it cut Medicare to pay for Obamacare. And of course, he was just constantly on the campaign trail saying, I would never do that. And so, you know, the Republican Party gets a really bad rap as the party of Medicare cuts, you know, pushing granny off the cliff and all that. But in a lot of ways, at least since the Romney candidacy, it's become the party preserving and protecting Medicare at all costs. I think you certainly see that under Trump.
Don't you agree, though, Peter? And I agree with, you know, the Tea Party in a very basic way was a kind of naive movement or a shallow movement, but they were right to say that Obamacare was going to increase federal spending and, you know, as well as increase federal control over insurance products. So I agree with you. You know, the Republicans, I mean, there was that glorious moment in 1994 or after the 94 Republican win, you know, to take over both houses of Congress, where the Congress and Clinton actually signed rescissions in Medicare spending, where people had to pony up a few more dollars a month. They quickly pulled it back because the backlash was so strong. And that was really the last time anybody seriously talked about reducing Medicare spending or putting more costs on seniors. But I think the Tea Party people were generally right to say, you know, this Obamacare did represent an increase in spending and an increase in kind of government control of the economy and of people's everyday life. And that was part and parcel of that movement, which really was a kind of barbaric yawp of American people after Bush. It's a shame they didn't take it out on Bush, because I think that would have clarified a lot of the issues, which later were seen as being, oh, well, you know, this was a white movement that was opposed to a black president, when in fact, I think the Tea Party early on, and this is something, you know, for those of us who covered it, there were not a lot of Confederate flags. I didn't hear any real conversation about, oh, Obama is a Kenyan, and that's why we don't want him to spend our money. It was really like, you know, how much more of this shit can we take? Where we're just being taxes are not covering what we're spending, and we're just spending more and more money that we don't have on stuff that we probably don't need.
But I think the ease with which the movement kind of shifted into immigration and more cultural issues shows that it wasn't just really a kind of devoted and, you know, a strict like and serious movement to reduce spending. And it wasn't even really about kind of fiscal conservative, limited government opposition to Obamacare, though, again, all of those things were part of the Tea Party. And so this is my point, is not that it was any one thing. It was multiple things, often at war with itself, but also often the different components, the different factions within the Tea Party were using the other factions to advance their own ideas and to try and say, well, the fiscal conservatives were taking the kind of just purely anti-Obama folks and saying, well, look, it's all about fiscal conservatism. And the cultural conservatives who were all about just being anti-Obama were saying, this is a movement of, you know, about sort of reclaiming who we are as a country. And it was all of those things all at once, and trying to pin it down and say it was just one thing, I think, is really a mistake.
Catherine, the people who watch me on MSNBC, let's call them MSNBC viewers, but I just wanted to put a plug that I was there. But no, every time I go on there and talk about these issues, they say, and many of their hosts do, look, the Tea Party was never about spending. Republicans have never been serious about deficits. They've never been serious about spending. All they wanted was to oppose a black president and to use this issue cynically when they're in opposition. Since you are the biggest cynic among all of us here, Catherine, except for Nick's cynicism about the International Olympic Movement, which we'll get into later, are they more right than our starry-eyed view of what those first protests were like?
I don't think so. I mean, it is certainly true that the Republican Party never delivers on its rhetoric about fiscal conservatism or responsibility. At the same time, I do think it's not totally meaningless that this is a thing Republicans have been saying forever, and that it was a thing that like showed up in Sharpie on these signs in this Tea Party moment. Again, I don't think people had the guts to actually do it. And I think ultimately the reading of the Tea Party as an upswell of support for that particular leg of the like 16-legged stool that is American conservatism or whatever, I think that was a misreading of the Tea Party. But I also don't think it's just a veil for racism or just a kind of a tactic, because it's not a great tactic, right? Like, if you were trying to think of something to say that would bring a bunch of Americans over to your party so that you could then be fascist racists unmolested by the rest of the American public, you wouldn't be like, you know what people love? Fiscal discipline. People love austerity. Like, if Europe tells us anything, it's that people are totally into that and vote for it. Wrong. Like, this is a terrible way to win over the populace. So I think, at the very least, that is evidence that there's some sincerity in there. But I think the read, I think Thomas Massie's read on the Tea Party is the right read, which is his great quote about, all this time I thought they were voting for libertarian Republicans, but after some soul searching, I realized that when they voted for Rand and Ron and me in these primaries, they weren't voting for libertarian issues and ideas. They were voting for the craziest son of a bitch in the race. And Donald Trump won best in class, as we had up until he came along. And that's it. Like, that's, you know, Matt Kibbe's piece at Reason today is great and detailed and is a lovely autopsy, but that's the too long didn't read.
I wonder, Nick, if we can blame our late friend Andrew Breitbart a little bit for this. So I do that in a friendly type of way. Kibbe in his piece points at Sarah Palin as being someone who kind of hijacked the movement to her own sense of glory, but also her own sense of kind of cultural grievances. Andrew didn't operate necessarily out of the same sense of cultural grievances, but he also did.
Sure, he totally did. What are you talking about?
I was attempting to make a distinction that would be too difficult for my brain to explain. So let's lump him into that. I don't think he was an opportunist in the way that Sarah Palin is necessarily, but he was consumed with this sort of sense. Of outrage at being surrounded in, you know, Brentwood and everywhere else that he went in D.C., New York, by a kind of liberal groupthink that he despised. And he was sort of one of the earlier and more successful kind of trolls, by which I mean someone who knows exactly how to push the buttons on the left, and so pushes those buttons, gets a detonator on those buttons there. I don't think that he's a troll in the same sense that Dinesh D'Souza is, not the sort of performative, I am going to inhabit the space that you're doing, that you've demonized me. Andrew was more kind of operating on sort of journalism counterpunching in that space. But ultimately, it's kind of a troll act. It's not about ideology, as he would be the quick to point out. And now we have a troll president. We literally have a troll president. Axios had a piece today, I think, talking about, and it's Axios. You have no idea what source. It's all these weird like bullet points. Click to read all 280 words. Like, what? But it basically posited
Axios.
It posited that 2018, from the Trump point of view, it's like, we're going to faint towards caring about infrastructure, but really we're going to look for some more football kneeling episodes, more culture war. We need to troll more. So it's trolling at the heart of kind of the rot, both of this sort of descent of the Tea Party, but even the pre-Tea Party descent of conservatism into this kind of Ann Coulter-ish, look at me out here, I'm outraging your sensibilities, big media.
I just want to point out, I'm pretty sure I'm not the only person on this podcast who's having an Admiral Stockdale moment right now. If I'm the only one besides Matt who remembers who Admiral Stockdale, I don't know what
I'm having
you're
an Admiral
talking
Ackbar
about.
Moment.
No, yeah. It's
John
all,
Stockton moment.
It
My
is
shorts
all
are so small.
Yeah, no. Well,
it's a trap.
It is a trap. I don't know why I'm here anymore.
wow.
You know, the one thing I want to point out is that we are also trying to adhere. Last week, a listener named Ryan Giuliano, who look him up on Twitter, RYAN. Giuliano, Juliano, put out a Reason podcast bingo, and we've been trying studiously to avoid hitting any of the squares that he put out there. And we've already mentioned Rand Paul and Justin Amash. Matt and I tried to tiptoe around a book that we wrote together a few years mm-hmm. ago, whose name we're
that's,
not allowed
see?
To say.
Now,
we've
no,
got
that's
someone references how well, George W. Bush was terrible on spending. So
okay,
there
yeah,
you go,
so
Nick.
We're practical. Well, I mean, the only thing we haven't landed on is there ain't no such thing as a free space. Whoops, we just did. To get back to your large point, Matt, I do think you know, Breitbart is really an important figure here, not simply because his influence is felt on the right, and he was brilliant at kind of pissing off people on the left. Like he knew where to kind of put the scalpel, or like the he could dig under your ribs
and
get to that.
The flamethrower, not the scalpel.
No, well, I mean, what it was, though, is that like in a big issue, he would take something and then he would find the one thing that would like drive lefties berserk, but also make, you know, right wingers salivate like, you know, Pavlov's dogs or something like that. And inevitably, it was never about a substantive issue. It was always about something that was relatively small and culture warish. And so, like, you know, one of his first big forays was the story about Shirley Sherrod, who was a Department of Agriculture official. And he pointed out in a long post, which most people didn't read the bottom of, that she at one point had said that she wasn't going to help white farmers get farm subsidies, but she would help black farmers. And her whole point of that story, and he told this in his piece, was that she walked away from that belief system because it was wrong. But that's what became the whole thing. You know, the whole thing about Acorn and voting, Acorn giving money to a pimp and a prostitute who were dressed up. It was a James O'Keefe. It was like his first joint, which was it wasn't so much that it was edited weirdly, but like he spliced in his video portrayal of it, him and the woman with him walking around D.C. in pimp and prostitute clothes as if they had gone into the Acorn offices like that, which they hadn't. And it's like, you know, suddenly you're not talking about these large, important ideas, you know, which are like, OK, the federal government is spending, you know, 30% more a year than it's bringing in. That's not good. It fucks things up for all sorts of reasons. And instead, you're talking about Acorn, which gets money to register voters or to, you know, do this or that. And it's a real problem. And I think it's a real problem on the right, because you see like the de-evolution of any pretense, for the most part, to ideas and ideology in the best sense of that word. And it's all about trolling stuff. And it's all about picking up the dumbest thing that you can find to say about Nancy Pelosi or about Chuck Schumer or about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, who aren't even in office anymore. And the right spends as much time talking about those people, you know, past leaders or failed candidates, as it does anything that's on the table now, except for immigration, where it's like, they are a troll act on immigration. They're not interested at all in having a broad discussion about the benefits of immigration. It's all just like, as long as there is one illegal immigrant anywhere who is breaking a traffic law, that means they all got to go. And you're right.
That's where the White House comes in with their illegal immigrant crime email of the week. Catherine, you were working on, did you publish this, by the way, a column that kind of touched on some of these incipient, word of which I don't really know what it means, trolling issues on the right. So either tell us what's going on with that column, or tell us the insights that you gleaned from thinking on this topic.
That's still upcoming, but I think that there's a real horrific feedback loop of the smug style of liberalism and the trolling from the right. And it's really not clear who started it. I'm not sure that you can sort that out in any meaningful way, but
oh, yes, you can. It's Daniel Patrick Moynihan. No matter what, it's always his fault.
Oh, I see. This is just a baseline rule that we're going with. That's fair.
Yes.
The idea that the Democratic Party and sort of the left generally lost working class voters and then immediately turned on them and said, "You idiots have no idea what's good for you. Let you know, sit down, shut up, and let us tell you." And those idiots in turn said, basically, "Hold my beer," and started the movement that led us to Donald Trump. Whether you count that movement as beginning in the Tea Party or not, everyone's behaving badly. But I think the thing that's telling to me is that this is happening entirely on the aesthetic level, that there's very little underlying principle at stake here, right? It used to be, okay, you know, you guys love communists and you guys only love the Pope or whatever. Like, let's, you know, there was sort of some underlying principle kind of anchoring the hateful speech. Federalists and anti-federalists, like, pick your thing. This literally just seems to be, you are talking rudely to me. No, you are talking rudely to me. Oh, yeah, I'll show you rude. And that seems, I am generally strongly anti-Golden Ageism. I always believe everything has been exactly as bad as it is today, if not worse. But I do think this might be one place where we are worse off than our parents.
Peter, let's talk about what's precisely bad about this budget that passed from your point of view.
Everything, basically.
So look, the
deal, the budget deal was basically an agreement between Republican defense hawks who wanted to spend more money on the military and Democrats who wanted to spend more money on everything else. And so I really think that and it was an agreement to raise the sequester caps that were probably the biggest, maybe the only meaningful Tea Party policy victory that restrained both defense and domestic spending, domestic discretionary spending, put in place back in 2011. And those caps have been broken since. This is the biggest breaking of those caps that we've ever seen up to this point. It's about $300 billion over the next 2 years, plus an additional $90 billion in emergency spending. And it's even worse than that, because what this really does is it sets a new baseline for spending. And so if you extrapolate this out a decade, they're not going to go back to the old spending levels. They're going to keep these spending levels and, if anything, probably break through them even more. And so if you go extrapolate this out a decade or so, it ends up being about a $1.7 trillion deficit increase over a decade. And that is, of course, on top of the $1.5 trillion deficit increase in that was included as part of the tax overhaul. So the Republican Party's two biggest achievements in Congress since taking power in the White House and taking majority control of both the House and the Senate have been to raise the deficit by probably something on the order of $3.25 trillion, maybe more than that, depending on how all of this shakes out. I just want to single out one specific policy that was included in this that hasn't gotten enough attention, in my opinion, and that is the repeal of IPAB, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which was a Medicare cost control board that was included in Obamacare. They repealed Medicare's cost control mechanism and didn't replace it with anything. That tells you where our parties are at.
Just to follow up on that, so that was part of the budget deal that happened on Friday?
Yep.
That got signed a lot? And
that
what was
correct.
The... What was the was did anyone justify this, or is this just sort of happened?
The justification
in the middle
is that Republicans and Democrats have not liked the Independent Payment Advisory Board for a long time because guess what what IPAB does? It cuts Medicare, right? It is death panels. It is in fact what Sarah Palin was talking about when she complained about death panels. Now, there is a legitimate criticism of IPAB, which is that its structure is arguably unconstitutional. And some of our friends in the libertarian think tank world have said that it is that basically it shouldn't be allowed under the Constitution. I think that that's they make a quite good argument there. But you don't want to repeal the cost control board and then replace it with nothing. You want to repeal the unconstitutional cost control board and then replace it with meaningful spending controls. Instead, what they did was they repealed it as part of a package that blows up the deficit even more.
Is there anyone, and maybe Catherine, I'll point in your direction just because you're pessimistic in life. Is there now any green shoots in the argument for the argument of restraining government spending on the federal level or even on the local level for that matter? I mean, local level to a degree that I had stopped paying as much attention to. But I wrote a column last week for the LA Times and just like, let's do a quick Google on how the old pensions are doing in California, which is something the Reason Foundation does a lot of stuff on. And pension costs, obligations, annual payouts are going to increase by 50% in 7 years on average in California cities. It's just like it's like impossibly bad. So the thing that kind of sticks in my craw in this is like, who is going to be making any argument about maybe we ought not to spend all the money all the time on all the things going forward? And will they not be immediately met with gales of laughter and pointing and colorful Italian insults and profanities?
The argument is still being made. I mean, that's the thing that's kind of remarkable to me. And I guess this gets back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the podcast. There has never been a shortage of argument. We've got the argument for why we shouldn't spend all the money that we don't have forever. Nobody's confused about that. So it's not like... I think the temptation, particularly by those of us who do words for a living, is to say, like, if someone could just say exactly the right words and exactly the right order, people who have power to do things would do the right things. And all the right words have been said in the right order for a very long time now.
Rand Paul said them last week.
In fact, at great length in the middle of the night, he said all the right words in the right order. And then he rearranged the order slightly and said them again. And then he rearranged the order slightly and said them again. And then Bette Midler tweeted that he should be physically assaulted for doing that. So, you know, the American political discourse is going great. And
when you've lost Bette Midler, you've lost the country.
Yeah. Yes, so it's not a lack of the argument. I am also a deep skeptic of the things have to get really, really bad so that then they can get better, right? This is a sort of kissing cousin of the wilderness argument that if the Republicans really get walloped and get sent out into the darkness, then they'll rediscover their fiscal conservatism. That seems to never happen.
It didn't work out so well for the Jews,
they got sent to the wilderness.
Right?
And they came back and they were like, so here's the plan, not fiscal conservatism. You know, I think this tweet from Trump on the occasion of the signing of this spending bill, where he says, our military will be stronger than ever before. We love and need our military, and gave them everything, M-dash, and more. First time this has happened in a long time. Also means jobs, jobs, jobs. Like, that, that's our philosophy
but,
now.
But what about jobs? You know, it doesn't seem like he emphasized jobs.
It's three jobs. Yeah. Is there in all caps? I couldn't perhaps sufficiently convey the all caps. Only Matt can speak in all caps among us. But that's what we're going with now. It's certainly not going to come out of the Republican Party. I think that's the answer. And, oh, wait, let's think for a minute. It's also definitely not going to come out of the Democratic Party. So I think we're just screwed.
So either you're calling for armed revolution or just huffing all the glue.
Yeah, I'm definitely.
I choose.
Definitely does, Mark McDaniel's any, excellent. Oh, bingo are, square.
Are there bingo domestic square, totally. Are there domestic manufacturers of airplane glue, or do we have to go? I mean, like, is Krylon paint? Is
Chinese airplane glue is better? Definitely.
I think the Jones Act precludes us from buying Chinese glue, except for after paying a 35% tariff. Speaking of Chinese glue, Nick, you wrote a post this morning about the Olympics. Over the weekend, I thought actually this is, when it started was going to be a, one of these pointless, political culture war, things where, conservatives would find like the one bad tweet from someone affiliated with a media organization saying something that's semi nice about the sister of Kim Jong-un, hanging out in a box with Mike Pence and looking, half glamorous. And like, then they just wouldn't stop. It was like the New York Times, it was Reuters, Think Progress, a bunch of different places. What the living hell, Nick? Is it now that the media is starting to troll the expected anti-media people out there?
I think the important thing to understand is that, you know, legacy media, and nothing says legacy media more than NBC. You know, they're desperate. Like, they're in the same position as the kind of movie studios, which were in well into the late 60s. And after almost two decades of decline of box office and of viewership in movie theaters, they had no idea what was going on. And so they're trying everything desperately to maintain market share or relevance. And you got to put places like the New York Times and Reuters into that too. I mean, we're in a fast moving, simultaneously fast moving and slow lurch away from how we used to collect news or how we used to gather and read news. And these are places that have shrinking audiences, and they're desperate to try and come up with new ways of capturing views. The Olympics are, you know, it's a great example of, it's been declining in overall viewership for decades now because nobody really cares about them anymore for a wide variety of reasons, including the end of the Cold War and a different view towards geopolitics, towards more weird sports being broadcast more time because people can get stuff. Matt, you and I are old enough to remember when, I mean, if you were into, I don't know, you know, like, you know, canoe racing or, you know, kayaking, the only time you would see that was once every 4 years.
Is there a difference?
Yeah, there is actually.
Nick's old enough to remember when people used canoes.
Yeah, canoes. Like, well, you know, you would make them. That's how you got to school every morning, even in landlocked parts of the country.
Wrapped your feet in newspaper and got in the canoe.
No, but
after
it's,
global warming, we're going to go back to that.
Yeah, but
Peter
it's,
went
I
on
mean,
one
it's
of those
just
boats that had like the gentle bend in the back.
Oh yeah, no, he had the big fan boats. Yeah, with where the bus drivers, the part-time bus drivers, were all unemployed bears. It's just such a different world, and you see, and also the idiocy of the mainstream media. I mean, NBC also fired an announcer. If you watch the opening ceremonies and where, like, you know, you had geopolitical and fashion advice from Katie Couric and a bunch of other people talking, and, you know, one guy talked about how everybody in Korea loves Japan because, you know, they're such an economic dynamo and they're the model, and like, you know, that is not necessarily wrong, but he missed the notion that Japan and Korea hate each other. And if South Korea, the Republic of Korea, hates one country more than North Korea, it's Japan, which brutally occupied the Hermit Kingdom, you know, within recent memory. And, you know, they NBC then, you know, caved and fired the guy and sheepishly, you know, remonstrated in front of the Korean government, which accepted its apology. But all of this stuff is to say nobody cares. And it was up to BuzzFeed and relatively young people in the media like Jake Tapper at CNN to point out that North Korea, or rather that Korea and Japan, have a strained relationship because of recent history. So all we're seeing
here and read this amazing BuzzFeed headline about the Kim Jong-un sister versus Mike Pence moment, which is PSA: Kim Jong-un's sister is not your new fave shade queen. She's a garbage monster. Subhead, what the hell is wrong with you people?
It's pretty great.
And that's right. Yeah. That is right. That is a good hot take.
And that was where Jake Tapper followed up by saying, like, you know, if you think, like, you know, that Mike Pence is worse than the North Korean government, why don't you take a look at this? And it was a link to a Human Rights Watch summary of just how awful North Korea is. And Kim Jong-un's sister is implicated in that regime. So
yeah, but Mike Pence can't have dinner with Kim Jong-un's sister alone.
Why would he? No, he had his wife. He was sitting next to his wife the whole time.
If Kim Yo-jung has dinner with Mike Pence, she's literally going to be killed the minute she gets home. So I think, you know, the no dinner together rule definitely goes both ways.
Catherine, you're a lady. Bingo. I am a lady every single week,
so it's you're not wrong.
Is she not a slay queen? Our Nork dictatress. Have you been watching at all the Olympics? Did we lure you with sports ball by having people dressing up in sequins and prancing around on ice skates? And how do you like to read obviously fashionista takes on a dictator?
First of all, hashtag problematic. Second of all, I had to ask our intern, Alec Ward, this morning if anything happened on the Olympics that I should know about for the podcast. So no, you cannot lure me in.
You didn't watch Tonga's famously semi-naked and highly greased up flag bearer?
What's wrong with you people? No, I do not like my sports with more nationalism is not like what I'm longing for. I am super interested, though, in this core of North Korean beautiful cheerleader ladies have come with the team.
The
230 women, all of whom must be at least 5'3" tall and deemed beautiful by the state. They are there to help out.
That's government overreach.
They're there to help out with the sports events.
Like to see the regulation.
I'm sure there is. I'm sure there's like a, it's going to be like the Pentagon's brownie recipe. It's like 47 pages of how to be a beautiful lady that goes with the Olympic team.
And then I
want to
see like the think tanks weighing in on how to make the regulation better.
Oh, like
better,
you want to know like what the CEI of North Korea has to say.
I want to go to the AEI panel on this. With it.
Yeah. No, it could be more efficient at least and produce less deadweight loss. I think that element of it is like a weird, the New York Times headline was North Korea's lipstick diplomacy. That's clearly what we're getting with our new fave shade queen.
It's a wrinkle in time diplomacy. I mean, that it is so absolutely creepy to see synchronized joy. Like they were at the in the opening ceremonies as well.
Why you got to be that way, Matt? Come on.
I agree. Synchronized joy is creepy as hell. And
it's also a bad Olympic event.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't know. They're all bad events, but that one in particular. I think also, though, we always love to make hay about how like, oh, look at these sort of quasi totalitarian states or actual totalitarian states doing their synchronized joy, when in fact, America sends our share of synchronized joy to the games every year as well. We are not better than them.
Wrong.
So you're just a moral equivalency. There's no difference between Mike Pence and Kim Jong-un's sister.
No.
Yeah.
Wow. Here's the difference.
Maybe she is my new fave shade queen.
Peter Suderman, here's the difference, is that despite our obvious advantages in wealth and freedom and material, this and that, we still are the worst dressed Olympic squad as we walk into an opening ceremony.
Oh, no, you're wrong, Matt. And
who's worse?
Ireland was wearing an outfit that, as I recall, your French
Please
wife
Please tell me they had on Tam O'Shanters.
No, but they were wearing an outfit that looked exactly like what Parisian pooper scoopers that are employees of the state use. I mean, they look like the uniform guys who clean up dog shit on the streets of Paris.
That's self-hatred, Nick. It's really
it is
a good look.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Suderman, please tell
me
that at least...
I'm sorry. I want to correct the record here. Tam O'Shanters are Scottish. As soon as I said it, I realized it was wrong. I apologize to the
50 lashes with a shillelagh. Yeah.
Who are and are not part of the British Isles as they prefer.
Peter, please tell me that any of the bars in D.C. that play C-SPAN 2 nonstop are at least switching over to some of the snowboarding events?
I've been drinking at home recently, so I really couldn't tell you. And if I found a bar that had switched from C-SPAN 2 over to the Olympics,
his
rating
on Uber
find somewhere
dropped below
else.
2, so he can't even get Ubers anymore.
Who has time for the Olympics? The budget news is too exciting, man.
It really is. And look, I'm just like, I do not understand why people get excited about the Olympics as like a... from a sort of nationalistic perspective. I just am not able to, like, I could describe it, but I'm not really able to grok it in my mind in some fundamental sense.
And ladies and gentlemen, there we have the summary of why libertarians struggle to convince people to join our movement.
So,
I don't understand why people like to be part of teams and have a feeling
of
loyalty.
That's true. I don't understand why people like rooting for sports teams, and I never have and I never will. I didn't when I had to go to every football game in my hometown in Florida. Bingo. No, but seriously, I consider myself a patriot. I love America. I think it's a great country. I really do think that, like, this is a great place to live. I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. But that's because it's founded on good ideals. And if we didn't enter anyone into the Olympics, or if all of our Olympians came in last place in every single event, it wouldn't make America any worse or less interesting or less good or noble or courageous a country. It wouldn't matter at all.
Oh my God, you guys, who's going to take me the bet on when Donald Trump tweets taking credit for a record number of Olympic golds? He's going to take credit. He's going to be like, nobody's died in airline crashes. People are saying Merry Christmas again. I won all the gold medals.
Jobs.
We're not going to win a record number of golds, Catherine.
Whatever.
It's going to be the stateless Russians.
First of all, the stateless Russians.
I love,
first of all,
I
he doesn't
all
need to
athletes.
Actually
the
have.
The Russians are, they're the anarchists at the Olympics. And I mean, maybe I could support that. I don't. I'm not pro-Russian.
That sounded like a panicky denial right there.
For anyone who's listening, Peter is definitely, definitely not pro-Russian.
You caught yourself out. I don't know how to segue exactly this into Rob Porter. So let's just segue into Rob Porter here. It is the topic of conversation among Washington watchers. Certainly a lot of inside parlor crap about whether Chief of Staff John Kelly is going to resign or not. I think it's very, very unlikely that he is. And I think it's the usual kind of Trump administration gossip. But just kind of on a larger level, a guy, Rob Porter, who is supposed to be handling interference, or was until he resigned, of what gets on the president's desk and these types of things, has two different ex-wives give interviews to the FBI, which are, you know, you can't lie to them. That's a crime, in which they allege that he hit them a lot. One of them even has photographic evidence. One of the two at least says that she thinks that he would be vulnerable to blackmail as a result. There's a third ex-girlfriend who calls up the White House, John Kelly, last fall, saying that, hey, I think he's got some issues. You should think about it here. All of this comes to a head in a Daily Mail article from a week ago or tomorrow on Tuesday. And the first reaction of John Kelly, also of the White House, and also of Orrin Hatch, where Rob Porter used to work, is this is a vile smear campaign. just kind of like set all the parlor crap aside, what planet are we living on when that is like the first reaction to something like that? Nick?
I'm sorry. I was reading reason.com, but
stroking out over here.
It's a good website. Everybody,
how's it going, Admiral? Still good?
Yeah, you know, it's I am in charge of a civilization, as Admiral Stockdale was. It's messed up, Matt, to say the least, especially given the the past 6 months or so of stories related to this. I don't know, though. By the same token, it's on some level, you want to find out what went on with the White House vetting process, if in fact there was one, because it could be that this issue was raised and it was dealt with in a way that we're not privy to. I actually would reject, even talking about this, because it's, while, obviously domestic abuse is not a small issue, it's not clear to me that this is serving, that larger cause. And it's more about, the more that people in the media especially get, suckered into talking about the daily, tumult in the Trump White House, we devote less energy to larger issues like the budget issue, like immigration, like foreign policy and free trade and things like that. So I don't have a strong opinion about this. And I think that doubtful, I don't want to read about all the ins and outs of the Trump White House. It's better to think about I think it's generally better to think about White Houses as black boxes. And I don't care what goes on. They spit out a particular policy or behavior or pellet of information. And that's what we need to be worried about.
I don't know, dude. I feel like that is not the right hot take right there. I mean, we are living in the Me Too moment. This is, if nothing else, I agree, of course, that we have to ask some questions about the vetting process, though I think it seems super clear that the Trump White House vetting process is not a thing.
And they want to vet everybody coming into the country, too.
Yeah, let's vet extreme vetting for everyone, not for people who literally work next door to my office, though.
Well, then,
Let her go. Go on.
But I think that just it shows that there is a total breakdown between the broader national sentiment about how we really need to rethink the way that we respond to these kind of allegations, because in the past there has been a great injustice done to disbelieve people who say that they've been abused or mistreated in favor of powerful men. We need to sort of do a formal correction. We are in the middle of doing that correction, as Liz Nolan Brown has written, as I have written. We are doing it really pretty well in the private sector, not flawlessly by any freaking stretch, but pretty good. It's going okay. And to have the White House just go straight to, this is a smear, don't believe the woman, stand by your man at all costs, it shows that you can, the feeling of this social movement as being impactful, sorry, the word impactful is awful, as being real, is possibly a false feeling, and that we could easily revert if people in power don't choose to join the movement.
I would also add, and maybe Peter, I'll throw it in your direction, to see the president tweet about the importance of due process feels a bit like setting half your house on fire on some level. I totally agree. Due process is absolutely great, and we should, especially in the Me Too movement, especially with cases like Stephen Henderson from the Detroit Free Press, who was fired based on just the flimsiest of OPPO research. Terrible stuff here. But of all of the major political figures in this country who are not credible, let's say, I won't say shouldn't, are not credible on the issue of due process, doesn't Trump rank in the top 10?
Yeah, look, so there's a couple of takeaways here. Number one is don't beat your wife. Number two is don't beat your wife. Number three is don't beat your spouse, husband, boyfriend, girlfriend, anybody else. Don't beat people, period.
Just to be clear, we here at The Reason Podcast, anti-beating.
Yep, seriously. But it also tells us something, I think, or at least highlight something we already knew about Donald Trump, which is that he does a very bad job of controlling who works around with and for him. He has done this since his campaign. And he has consistently just picked up bad people, and then he has defended them when they have come up for criticism in a lot of cases, and defended them in ways that really are just kind of bullshitty. And I don't know how else to put it, right? Like this defense of Porter here, when there are photos, is just horseshit. And that's Donald Trump's instinct. And I think that tells us something that's very worrying about our president and how he reacts to criticism and how he makes decisions. And in particular, sort of his personnel decision making process is at best sloppy and not well thought through. And in a White House that is already kind of under-experienced and doesn't have a really kind of coherent agenda and sense of what it wants to do, that is a real problem. And that actually affects policy issues and the ability of the White House to get its message out, to get anything done, to move forward on important issues, and to talk and to deal with things well.
I agree
like
with
the,
all
the
of
budget,
that,
immigration,
but this
whatever
is...
all of these kind of policy issues are.
I agree with all of that. And my basic point still holds how much time are you going to spend every day being outraged by new stupidities coming out of the Trump White House?
All the time, every day.
This is like, I think it would be. You know, it's more important and it's more central, not to, you know, specific issues, but like Trump, the reason why Trump is turning out to be a mixed president, if not an awful president in many ways, is not because of his hiring practices. That reflects larger issues that he has much more control over. And I think, you know, to the extent that we talk about this stuff, and I'm not brushing it away or anything like that, I'm just saying, like, you know, this is part of the troll strategy. Trump inflames people over this stuff so that he can do other things and people aren't even paying attention to it. We have spent more time this weekend in the media talking about this story and about the Olympics than we are, about the actual, budget deal that was, you know, signed, sealed and delivered over the weekend.
White
and that
paper
budget deal. That budget deal is going to have a much bigger effect, you know, coming out of Washington than anything else that we're talking about this weekend.
I'll just go back to my call for the State of the Union to be basically an incredibly boring, highly detailed white paper. If we treat all of government like that, people will tune out. It will become in some ways a little bit more technocratic and less democratic. But I think we will still have the democratic mechanisms in place and we will end up with a more substantive and importantly more boring government that we won't treat like a reality show.
It is so easy to disturb the equilibrium that you're describing, though. All you have to do to totally wreck white paper government is to have one person stand up and say America is an idea about eagles. Or you just have one person who stands up and says, let's talk about, you know, somebody's, you know, bedroom activities. Let's talk about whatever. Let's pick something that people are inherently interested in because we are built to share and retain gossip. That is what the human brain is for. Like, white paper government is an equilibrium that can never exist in nature because it will be immediately disrupted by this. And this is the best we can do when we have a big conversation about seemingly inconsequential stuff is to try and say, okay, well, how does this point to something bigger? And in this case, I think the bigger thing it points to is whether or not politics is ultimately subject to the, I think, overall positive changes in how we deal with accusations of misconduct toward women.
I just want to point out that you used the phrase bedroom activities.
I did. I don't know what happened there. Domestic abuse, but then I like lost that phrase. And so bedroom activities is what happened. I don't know. Probably this is Liz Nolan Brown's fault.
That's like putting your duvet on your comforter.
Yes.
We have, thankfully, a small amount of time left here. And we want to experiment with a new feature here, an end of podcast feature called, Hey, What's Your Part of Reason Working On? And we might come up with a new title later, but I think
that's real catchy, though. Yeah.
I think so. Actually, what we're going to call it is bedroom activities. So, Nick, what kind of bedroom activities are we going to see over at reason television or even the podcast for the rest of the week, to the extent that you know the answer to that question at while you're surfing reason.com as we speak?
We've got a great interview coming out with Morris Fiorina. He's a Hoover Institution and Stanford political scientist who writes a lot about how while we think about politics as being particularly polarized now, it's actually only the parties that are being polarized, and the American people tend to agree in large and growing majorities about a lot of things related to things like the treatment of women, immigration being in favor of it, pot legalization being in favor of it, gay marriage being in favor of it, and that the fundamental disconnect is between how we can express our opinions through increasingly polarized parties. So we have an interview with him coming out. We also have a great piece about where two Reason TV guys, Justin Monticello and Zach Weismuller, went to Berkeley, to UC Berkeley, and asked people on the campus whether or not it's okay to punch Nazis or where do you draw the line. So we've got a lot of good content like that coming out on Reason TV this week.
Very nice. Suter Pants, what are we? What kind of bedroom activities have you been working on?
In addition to last week's spending deal in Congress, the Trump administration also released its budget blueprint for the year today, along with its long, long, long awaited infrastructure plan. Yes, it is infrastructure week again.
Every week.
Yes, it's a sequel to Groundhog Day, and it's awful. But we're going to have some analysis of the infrastructure plan by Christian Britschke later today. And then we are also going to have a sure to be fiery and awesomely angry French libertarian budget analysis from Véronique de Rougy when she sees that Trump's budget plan gives up on even the idea of balancing the budget in the next decade.
Catherine, as the originator of the bedroom activities, what can we expect from the print magazine?
I would like to henceforth be referred to as the originator of the bedroom activities. It's my official title. Two things coming up in the next issue, which we are wrapping right now. One is a Jigundo cover story from Jacob Sullum, Reason's official, final, last and ongoing word on the opioid epidemic. This is something that we've been working on for a long time. It looks at both the prescription pain pills, sort of restrictionist approach and how that is hurting people, and also the more standard drug war, crackdown on, black market opiates. It's a pretty impressive piece of research and analysis by our very own Jacob Sullum. Thing number two in the issue, it is Frankenstein's 200th birthday. And Ron Bailey is going to tell us about why, from the very first moment, people have misunderstood the lessons of Frankenstein. So stay tuned for that.
What is the lesson of Frankenstein? You never wear a turtleneck with a blazer. Frankenstein's monster. You know, that was the fatal flaw of 20s fashion.
That's it. You nailed it. Wait, spoiler alert. Nick.
Sorry about that.
Look, you just can't stop a mind from working that fast, Catherine.
I've tried. I'm heavily sedated most days, and I still, things manage to slip through.
I think that's all the bingo square checking that we have time for here. Thank you to all for listening. Again, subscribe to this here Reason podcast on your iTunes and rate and review us. For Catherine Ringer Ward and Peter Sutherland. Sullivan, I guess his name is, and Nick Lesby. I am Matt Welch. We will see you later. Goodbye.